Child of Athena, he decided. No one can bring down the cavern of Mithras, especially with one strike. Especially not a girl.
Annabeth hefted her dagger. The ceiling was low. She could reach the capstone easily. But she'd have to make her one strike count. The doorway behind her was blocked, but in theory, if the room started to collapse, those bricks should weaken and crumble. She should be able to bust her way through before the entire ceiling came down, assuming, of course, that there was something behind the brick wall, not just solid earth, and assuming that Annabeth was quick enough and strong enough and lucky enough. Otherwise, she was about to be a demigod pancake. Well, boys, she said, looks like you chose the wrong war god. She struck the capstone. The celestial bronze blade shattered it like a sugar cube. For a moment, nothing happened.
Ha!
The potter gloated.
You see, Athena has no power here.
The room shook. A fissure ran across the length of the ceiling and the far end of the cavern collapsed, burying the altar and the potter. More cracks widened. Bricks fell from the arches. Ghosts screamed and ran, but they couldn't seem to pass through the walls. Apparently, they were bound to this chamber even in death. Annabeth turned. She slammed against the block entrance with all her might, and the bricks gave way. As the cavern of Mithras imploded behind her, she lunged into darkness and found herself falling. Chapter 35. Annabeth. Annabeth thought she knew pain. She had fallen off the lava wall at Camp Half-Blood. She'd been stabbed in the arm with a poison blade on the Williamsburg Bridge. She had even held the weight of the sky on her shoulders. But that was nothing compared to landing hard on her ankle. She immediately knew she'd broken it. Pain, like a hot steel wire, jabbed its way up her leg and into her hip. The world narrowed to just her, her ankle, and the agony. She almost blacked out. Her head spun. Her breath became short and rapid. No, she told herself. You can't go into shock. She tried to breathe more slowly. She lay as still as possible until the pain subsided from absolute torture to just horrible throbbing. Part of her wanted to howl at the world for being so unfair. All this way just to be stopped by something as common as a broken ankle? She forced her emotions back down. At camp, she'd been trained to survive in all sorts of bad situations, including injuries like this. She looked around her. Her dagger had skittered a few feet away. In its dim light, she could make out the features of the room. She was lying on a cold floor of sandstone blocks. The ceiling was 2 stories tall. The doorway through which she'd fallen was 10 feet off the ground, now completely blocked with debris that had cascaded into the room, making a rock slide. Scattered around her were old pieces of lumber. Some cracked and desiccated, others broken into kindling. Stupid, she scolded herself. She lunged through that doorway, assuming there would be a level corridor or another room. It had never occurred to her that she'd be tumbling into space. The lumber had probably once been a staircase, long ago collapsed. She inspected her ankle. Her foot didn't appear too strangely bent. She could feel her toes. She didn't see any blood. That was all good. She reached out for a piece of lumber. Even that small bit of movement made her yelp. The board crumbled in her hand. The wood might be centuries old or even millennia. She had no way of knowing if this room was older than the shrine of Mithras, or if, like the labyrinth, the rooms were a hodgepodge from many eras thrown randomly together. Okay, she said aloud just to hear her voice. Think, Annabeth. Prioritize. She remembered a silly wilderness survival course Grover had taught her back at camp. At least it had seemed silly at the time. First step, scan your surroundings for immediate threats. This room didn't seem to be in danger of collapsing. The rock slide had stopped. The walls were solid blocks of stone with no major cracks that she could see. The ceiling was not sagging. Good. The only exit was on the far wall. An arched doorway that led into darkness. Between her and the doorway, a small brickwork trench cut across the floor, letting water flow through the room from left to right. Maybe plumbing from the Roman days? If the water was drinkable, that was good too. Piled in one corner were some broken ceramic vases, spilling out shriveled brown clumps that might once have been fruit. Yuck. In another corner were some wooden crates that looked more intact, and some wicker boxes bound with leather straps. So no immediate danger, she said to herself, unless something comes barreling out of that dark tunnel. She glared at the doorway, almost daring her luck to get worse. Nothing happened. Okay, she said. Next step. Take inventory. What could she use? She had her water bottle and more water in that trench if she could reach it. She had her knife. Her backpack was full of colorful string. Whee! Her laptop, the bronze map, some matches, and some ambrosia for emergencies. Ah, yeah. This qualified as an emergency. She dug the godly food out of her pack and wolfed it down. As usual, it tasted like comforting memories. This time it was buttered popcorn, movie night with her dad at his place in San Francisco. No stepmom, no stepbrothers, just Annabeth and her father curled up on the sofa watching sappy old romantic comedies. The ambrosia warmed her whole body. The pain in her leg became a dull throb. Annabeth knew she was still in major trouble. Even ambrosia couldn't heal broken bones right away. It might speed up the process, but best case scenario, she wouldn't be able to put any weight on her foot for a day or more. She tried to reach her knife, but it was too far away. She scooted in that direction. Pain flared again, like nails were piercing her foot. Her face beaded with sweat, but after one more scoot, she managed to reach the dagger. She felt better holding it, not just for light and protection, but also because it was so familiar. What next? Grover's survival class had mentioned something about staying put and waiting for rescue, but that wasn't going to happen. Even if Percy somehow managed to trace her steps, the cavern of Mithras had collapsed. She could try contacting someone with Daedalus's laptop, but she doubted she could get a signal down here. Besides, who would she call? She couldn't text anyone who was close enough to help. Demigods never carried cell phones, because their signals attracted too much monstrous attention, and none of her friends would be sitting around checking their email. An iris message? She had water, but she doubted that she could make enough light for a rainbow. The only coin she had was her silver Athenian drachma, which didn't make a great tribute. There was another problem with calling for help. This was supposed to be a solo quest. If Annabeth did get rescued, she'd be admitting defeat. Something told her that the mark of Athena would no longer guide her. She could wander down here forever, and she'd never find the Athena Parthenos. So, no good staying put and waiting for help, which meant she had to find a way to keep going on her own. She opened her water bottle and drank. She hadn't realized how thirsty she was. When the bottle went empty, she crawled to the gutter and refilled it. The water was cold and moving swiftly. Good signs that it might be safe to drink. She filled her bottle, then cupped some water in her hands and splashed her face. Immediately she felt more alert. She washed off and cleaned her scrapes as best she could. Annabeth sat up and glared at her ankle. You had to break, she scolded it. The ankle did not reply. She'd have to immobilize it in some sort of cast. That was the only way she'd be able to move. She raised her dagger and inspected the room again in its bronze light. Now that she was closer to the open doorway, she liked it even less. It led into a dark, silent corridor. The air wafting out smelled sickly sweet and somehow evil. Unfortunately, Annabeth didn't see any other way she could go. With a lot of gasping and blinking back tears, she crawled over to the wreckage of the stairs. She found two planks that were in fairly good shape, and long enough for a splint. Then she scooted over to the wicker boxes and used her knife to cut off the leather straps. While she was psyching herself up to immobilize her ankle, she noticed some faded words on one of the wooden crates. Hermes Express. Annabeth scooted excitedly toward the box. She had no idea what it was doing here, but Hermes delivered all sorts of useful stuff to gods, spirits, and even demigods. Maybe he dropped this care package here years ago to help demigods like her with this quest. She pried it open and pulled out several sheets of bubble wrap. but whatever had been inside was gone. "Hermes," she protested. She stared glumly at the bubble wrap. Then her mind kicked into gear, and she realized the wrapping was a gift.
"Oh, that's perfect."
Annabeth covered her broken ankle in a bubble wrap cast. She set it with the lumber splints and tied it all together with the leather straps. Once before, in first aid practice, she'd splinted a fake broken leg for another camper, but she never imagined she'd have to make a splint for herself. It was hard, painful work, but finally it was done. She searched the wreckage of the stairs until she found part of the railing, a narrow board about 4 feet long that could serve as a crutch. She put her back against the wall, got her good leg ready, and hauled herself up.
"Whoa."
Black spots danced in her eyes, but she stayed upright. "Next time," she muttered to the dark room, "just let me fight a monster. Much easier." Above the open doorway, the mark of Athena blazed to life against the arch. The fiery owl seemed to be watching her expectantly, as if to say, "About time." "Oh, you want monsters? Right this way." Annabeth wondered if that burning mark was based on a real sacred owl. If so, when she survived, she was going to find that owl and punch it in the face. That thought lifted her spirits. She made it across the trench and hobbled slowly into the corridor. Chapter 36. Annabeth. The tunnel ran straight and smooth, but after her fall, Annabeth decided to take no chances. She used the wall for support and tapped the floor in front of her with her crutch to make sure there were no traps. As she walked, the sickly sweet smell got stronger and set her nerves on edge. The sound of running water faded behind her. In its place came a dry chorus of whispers like a million tiny voices. They seemed to be coming from inside the walls, and they were getting louder. Annabeth tried to speed up, but she couldn't go much faster without losing her balance or jarring her broken ankle. She hobbled onward, convinced that something was following her. The small voices were massing together, getting closer. She touched the wall, and her hand came back covered in cobwebs. She yelped, then cursed herself for making a sound. "It's only a web," she told herself. But that didn't stop the roaring in her ears. She'd expected spiders. She knew what was ahead. The Weaver. Her ladyship. The voice in the dark. But the webs made her realize how close she was. Her hand trembled as she wiped it on the stones. What had she been thinking? She couldn't do this quest alone. Too late, she told herself. Just keep going. She made her way down the corridor, one painful step at a time. The whispering sounds got louder behind her until they sounded like millions of dried leaves swirling in the wind. The cobwebs became thicker, filling the tunnel. Soon, she was pushing them out of her face, ripping through gauzy curtains that covered her like silly string. Her heart wanted to break out of her chest and run. She stumbled ahead more recklessly, trying to ignore the pain in her ankle. Finally, the corridor ended in a doorway filled waist-high with old lumber. It looked as if someone had tried to barricade the opening. That didn't bode well, but Annabeth used her crutch to push away the boards as best she could. She crawled over the remaining pile, getting a few dozen splinters in her free hand. On the other side of the barricade was a chamber the size of a basketball court. The floor was done in Roman mosaics. The remains of tapestries hung from the walls. Two unlit torches sat in wall sconces on either side of the doorway, both covered in cobwebs. At the far end of the room, the mark of Athena burned over another doorway. Unfortunately, between Annabeth and that exit, the floor was bisected by a chasm 50 feet across. Spanning the pit were two parallel wooden beams, too far apart for both feet, but each too narrow to walk on unless Annabeth was an acrobat, which she wasn't, and didn't have a broken ankle, which she did. The corridor she'd come from was filled with hissing noises. Cobwebs trembled and danced as the first of the spiders appeared, no larger than gumdrops, but plump and black, skittering over the walls and the floor. What kind of spiders? Annabeth had no idea. She only knew they were coming for her, and she only had seconds to figure out a plan. Annabeth wanted to sob. She wanted someone, anyone, to be here for her. She wanted Leo with his fire skills, or Jason with his lightning, or Hazel to collapse the tunnel. Most of all, she wanted Percy. She always felt braver when Percy was with her. "I am not going to die here," she told herself. "I'm going to see Percy again." The first spiders were almost to the door. Behind them came the bulk of the army, a black sea of creepy crawlies. Annabeth hobbled to one of the wall sconces and snatched up the torch. The end was coated in pitch for easy lighting. Her fingers felt like lead, but she rummaged through her backpack and found the matches. She struck one and set the torch ablaze. She thrust it into the barricade. The old dry wood caught immediately. Flames leaped to the cobwebs and roared down the corridor in a flash fire, roasting spiders by the thousands. Annabeth stepped back from her bonfire. She'd bought herself some time, but she doubted that she'd killed all the spiders. They would regroup and swarm again as soon as the fire died. She stepped to the edge of the chasm. She shined her light into the pit, but she couldn't see the bottom. Jumping in would be suicide. She could try to cross one of the bars hand over hand, but she didn't trust her arm strength. And she didn't see how she would be able to haul herself up with a full backpack and a broken ankle once she reached the other side. She crouched and studied the beams. Each had a set of iron eye hooks along the inside, set at 1 foot intervals. Maybe the rails had been the sides of a bridge and the middle planks had been removed or destroyed. But eye hooks? Those weren't for supporting planks. More like... She glanced at the walls. The same kind of hooks had been used to hang the shredded tapestries. She realized the planks weren't meant as bridge. They were some kind of loom. Annabeth threw her flaming torch to the other side of the chasm. She had no faith her plan would work, but she pulled all the string out of her backpack and began weaving between the beams, stringing a cat's cradle pattern back and forth from eye hook to eye hook, doubling and tripling the line. Her hands moved with blazing speed. She stopped thinking about the task and just did it, looping and tying off lines, slowly extending her woven net over the pit. She forgot the pain in her leg and the fiery barricade guttering out behind her. She inched over the chasm. The weaving held her weight. Before she knew it, she was halfway across. How had she learned to do this? "It's Athena," she told herself. "My mother's skill with useful crafts." Weaving had never seemed particularly useful to Annabeth. Until now. She glanced behind her. The barricade fire was dying. A few spiders crawled in around the edges of the doorway. Desperately, she continued weaving, and finally she made it across. She snatched up the torch and thrust it into her woven bridge. Flames raced along the string. Even the beams caught fire as if they'd been pre-soaked in oil. For a moment, the bridge burned in a clear pattern, a fiery row of identical owls. Had Annabeth really woven them into the string? Or was it some kind of magic? She didn't know, but as the spiders began to cross, the beams crumbled and collapsed into the pit. Annabeth held her breath. She didn't see any reason why the spiders couldn't reach her by climbing the walls or the ceiling. If they started to do that, she'd have to run for it, and she was pretty sure she couldn't move fast enough. For some reason, the spiders didn't follow. They massed at the edge of the pit, a seething black carpet of creepiness. Then they dispersed, flooding back into the burned corridor. Almost as if Annabeth was no longer interesting. "Or I passed a test," she said aloud. Her torch sputtered out, leaving her only the light of her dagger. She realized that she'd left her makeshift crutch on the other side of the chasm. She felt exhausted and out of tricks, but her mind was clear. Her panic seemed to have burned up along with that woven bridge. "The Weaver," she thought. "I must be close. At least I know what's ahead." She made her way down the next corridor, hopping to keep the weight off her bad foot. She didn't have far to go. After 20 feet, the tunnel opened into a cavern as large as a cathedral, so majestic that Annabeth had trouble processing everything she saw. She guessed that this was the room from Percy's dream. But it wasn't dark. Bronze braziers of magical light, like the gods used on Mount Olympus, glowed around the circumference of the room, interspersed with gorgeous tapestries. The stone floor was webbed with fissures like a sheet of ice. The ceiling was so high it was lost in the gloom, and layers upon layers of spider webs. Strands of silk as thick as pillars ran from the ceiling all over the room, anchoring the walls and the floor like the cables of a suspension bridge. Webs also surrounded the centerpiece of the shrine, which was so intimidating that Annabeth had trouble raising her eyes to look at it. Looming over her was a 40-foot-tall statue of Athena, with luminous ivory skin and a dress of gold. In her outstretched hand, Athena held a statue of Nike, the winged victory goddess, a statue that looked tiny from here, but was probably as tall as a real person. Athena's other hand rested on a shield as big as a billboard, with a sculpted snake peeking out from behind, as if Athena was protecting it. The goddess's face was serene and kindly, and it looked like Athena. Annabeth had seen many statues that didn't resemble her mom at all, but this giant version made thousands of years ago made her think that the artist must have met Athena in person. He had captured her perfectly.
"Athena Parthenos," Annabeth murmured. "It's really here."
All her life, she had wanted to visit the Parthenon. Now she was seeing the main attraction that used to be there. And she was the first child of Athena to do so in millennia. She realized her mouth was hanging open. She forced herself to swallow. Annabeth could have stood there all day looking at the statue, but she had only accomplished half her mission. She had found the Athena Parthenos. Now, how could she rescue it from this cavern? Strands of web covered it like a gauze pavilion. Annabeth suspected that without those webs, the statue would have fallen through the weakened floor long ago. As she stepped into the room, she could see that the cracks below were so wide she could have lost her foot in them. Beneath the cracks, she saw nothing but empty darkness. A chill washed over her. Where was the guardian? How could Annabeth free the statue without collapsing the floor? She couldn't very well shove the Athena Parthenos down the corridor that she'd come from. She scanned the chamber, hoping to see something that might help. Her eyes wandered over the tapestries, which were heart-wrenchingly beautiful. One showed a pastoral scene so three-dimensional it could have been a window. Another tapestry showed the gods battling the giants. Annabeth saw a landscape of the underworld. Next to it was the skyline of modern Rome. And in the tapestry to her left, she caught her breath. It was a portrait of two demigods kissing underwater. Annabeth and Percy. The day their friends had thrown them into the canoe lake at camp. It was so lifelike that she wondered if the weaver had been there, lurking in the lake with a waterproof camera.
"How is that possible?" she murmured.
Above her in the gloom, a voice spoke.
"For ages I have known that you would come, my sweet."
Annabeth shuddered. Suddenly she was 7 years old again, hiding under her covers, waiting for the spiders to attack her in the night. The voice sounded just as Percy had described, an angry buzz in multiple tones, female but not human. In the webs above the statue something moved, something dark and large.
"I have seen you in my dreams," the voice said,
sickly sweet and evil, like the smell in the corridors.
"I had to make sure you were worthy, the only child of Athena clever enough to pass my tests and reach this place alive. Indeed, you are her most talented child. This will make your death so much more painful to my old enemy when you fail utterly."
The pain in Annabeth's ankle was nothing compared to the icy acid now filling her veins. She wanted to run. She wanted to plead for mercy, but she couldn't show weakness. Not now. "You're Arachne," she called out. "The weaver, who is turned into a spider." The figure descended, becoming clearer and more horrible.
"Cursed by your mother," she said. "Scorned by all and made into a hideous thing. Because I was the better weaver."
"But you lost the contest," Annabeth said.
"That's the story written by the winner," cried Arachne. "Look on my work. See for yourself."
Annabeth didn't have to. The tapestries were the best she'd ever seen. Better than the witch Circe's work. And yes, even better than some weavings she'd seen on Mount Olympus. She wondered if her mother truly had lost. If she'd hidden Arachne away and rewritten the truth. But right now, it didn't matter. "You've been guarding this statue since the ancient times," Annabeth guessed. "But it doesn't belong here. I'm taking it back."
"Ha,"
Arachne said. Even Annabeth had to admit her threat sounded ridiculous. How could one girl in a bubble wrap ankle cast remove this huge statue from its underground chamber?
"I'm afraid you would have to defeat me first, my sweet," Arachne said. "And alas, that is impossible."
The creature appeared from the curtains of webbing, and Annabeth realized that her quest was hopeless. She was about to die. Arachne had the body of a giant black widow, with a hairy red hourglass mark on the underside of her abdomen and a pair of oozing spinnerets. Her 8 spindly legs were lined with curved barbs as big as Annabeth's dagger. If the spider came any closer, her sweet stench alone would have been enough to make Annabeth faint. But the most horrible part was her misshapen face. She might once have been a beautiful woman. Now black mandibles protruded from her mouth like tusks. Her other teeth had grown into thin white needles. Fine dark whiskers dotted her cheeks. Her eyes were large, lidless, and pure black, with 2 smaller eyes sticking out of her temples. The creature made a violent rip, rip, rip sound that might have been laughter.
"Now I will feast on you, my sweet," Arachne said. "But do not fear. I will make a beautiful tapestry depicting your death."
Chapter 37 Leo. Leo wished he wasn't so good. Really, sometimes it was just embarrassing. If he hadn't had such an eye for mechanical stuff, they might never have found the secret chute, gotten lost in the underground, and been attacked by metal dudes. But he just couldn't help himself. Part of it was Hazel's fault. For a girl with super underground senses, she wasn't much good in Rome. She kept leading them around and around the city, getting dizzy and doubling back.
"Sorry," she said. "It's just, there's so much underground here, so many layers, it's overwhelming. Like standing in the middle of an orchestra and trying to concentrate on a single instrument. I'm going deaf."
As a result, they got a tour of Rome. Frank seemed happy to plod along like a big sheepdog. Leo wondered if he could turn into one of those, or even better, a horse that Leo could ride. But Leo started to get impatient. His feet were sore, the day was sunny and hot, and the streets were choked with tourists. The forum was okay, but it was mostly ruins overgrown with bushes and trees. It took a lot of imagination to see it as the bustling center of ancient Rome. Leo could only manage it because he'd seen New Rome in California. They passed big churches, freestanding arches, clothing stores, and fast food restaurants. One statue of some ancient Roman dude seemed to be pointing to a nearby McDonald's. On the wider streets, the car traffic was absolutely nuts. Man, Leo thought people in Houston drove crazy. but they spent most of their time weaving through small alleys, coming across fountains and little cafes where Leo was not allowed to rest.
"I never thought I'd get to see Rome," Hazel said. "When I was alive, I mean the first time, Mussolini was in charge. We were at war."
"Mussolini?" Leo frowned. "Wasn't he like BFFs with Hitler?"
Hazel stared at him like he was an alien.
"BFFs?
Never mind."
"I'd love to see the Trevi Fountain," she said.
"There's a fountain on every block," Leo grumbled.
"Or the Spanish Steps," Hazel said.
"Why would you come to Italy to see Spanish Steps?" Leo asked. "That's like going to China for Mexican food, isn't it?"
"You're hopeless," Hazel complained.
"So I've been told."
She turned to Frank and grabbed his hand as if Leo had ceased to exist.
"Come on. I think we should go this way."
Frank gave Leo a confused smile, like he couldn't decide whether to gloat or to thank Leo for being a doofus, but he cheerfully let Hazel drag him along. After walking forever, Hazel stopped in front of a church. At least, Leo assumed it was a church. The main section had a big domed roof. The entrance had a triangular roof, typical Roman columns, and an inscription across the top. M. Agrippa, something or other.
"Latin for get a grip?" Leo speculated.
"This is our best bet."
Hazel sounded more certain than she had all day.
"There should be a secret passage somewhere inside."
Tour groups milled around the steps. Guides held up colored placards with different numbers and lectured in dozens of languages, like they were playing some kind of international bingo. Leo listened to the Spanish tour guide for a few seconds, and then he reported to his friends,
"This is the Pantheon. It was originally built by Marcus Agrippa as a temple to the gods. After it burned down, Emperor Hadrian rebuilt it, and it's been standing for 2,000 years. It's one of the best-preserved Roman buildings in the world."
Frank and Hazel stared at him.
"How did you know that?"
Hazel asked.
"I'm naturally brilliant."
"Centaur poop," Frank said. "He eavesdropped on a tour group."
Leo grinned.
"Maybe. Come on, let's go find that secret passage. I hope this place has air conditioning."
Of course, no AC. On the bright side, there were no lines and no admission fee, so they just muscled their way past the tour groups and walked on in. The interior was pretty impressive, considering it had been constructed 2,000 years ago. The marble floor was patterned with squares and circles like a Roman tic-tac-toe game. The main space was one huge chamber with a circular rotunda, sort of like a Capitol building back in the States. Lining the walls were different shrines and statues and tombs and stuff. But the real eye-catcher was the dome overhead. All the light in the building came from one circular opening right at the top. A beam of sunlight slanted into the rotunda and glowed on the floor, like Zeus was up there with a magnifying glass trying to fry puny humans. Leo was no architect like Annabeth, but he could appreciate the engineering. The Romans had made the dome out of big stone panels, but they'd hollowed out each panel in a square-within-square pattern. It looked cool. Leo figured it also made the dome lighter and easier to support. He didn't mention that to his friends. He doubted they would care. But if Annabeth were here, she would have spent the whole day talking about it. Thinking about that made Leo wonder how she was doing on her Mark of Athena expedition. Leo never thought he'd feel this way, but he was worried about that scary blonde girl. Hazel stopped in the middle of the room and turned in a circle.
"This is amazing. In the old days, the children of Vulcan would come here in secret to consecrate demigod weapons. This is where imperial gold was enchanted."
Leo wondered how that worked. He imagined a bunch of demigods in dark robes trying to quietly roll a scorpion ballista through the front doors.
"But we're not here because of that," he guessed.
"No," Hazel said. "There's an entrance, a tunnel that will lead us toward Nico. I can sense it close by. I'm not sure where."
Frank grunted.
"If this building is 2,000 years old, it makes sense there could be some kind of secret passage left over from the Roman days."
That's when Leo made his mistake of simply being too good. He scanned the temple's interior, thinking, if I were designing a secret passage, where would I put it? He could sometimes figure out how a machine worked by putting his hand on it. He learned to fly a helicopter that way. He'd fixed Festus the dragon that way, before Festus crashed and burned. Once he'd even reprogrammed the electronic billboards in Times Square to read, All the ladies love Leo. Accidentally, of course. Now he tried to sense the workings of this ancient building. He turned toward a red marble altar-looking thing with a statue of the Virgin Mary on the top. Over there, he said. He marched confidently to the shrine. It was shaped sort of like a fireplace with an arched recess at the bottom. The mantle was inscribed with a name, like a tomb. The passage is around here, he said. This guy's final resting place is in the way. Raphael somebody.
Famous painter, I think, Hazel said.
Leo shrugged. He had a cousin named Raphael, and he didn't think much of the name. He wondered if he could produce a stick of dynamite from his tool belt and do a little discreet demolition, but he figured the caretakers of this place probably wouldn't approve.
Hold on.
Leo looked around to make sure they weren't being watched. Most of the tour groups were gawking at the dome, but one trio made Leo uneasy. About 50 feet away, some overweight middle-aged dudes with American accents were conversing loudly, complaining to each other about the heat. They looked like manatees stuffed into beach clothes, sandals, walking shorts, touristy t-shirts, and floppy hats. Their legs were big and pasty and covered with spider veins. The guys acted extremely bored, and Leo wondered why they were hanging around. They weren't watching him. Leo wasn't sure why they made him nervous. Maybe he just didn't like manatees. Forget them, Leo told himself. He slipped around the side of the tomb. He ran his hand down the back of a Roman column all the way to the base. Right at the bottom, a series of lines had been etched into the marble. Roman numerals.
Hey, Leo said. Not very elegant, but effective.
What is?
Frank asked.
The combination for a lock.
He felt around the back of the column some more and discovered a square hole about the size of an electrical socket.
The lock face itself has been ripped out, probably vandalized sometime in the last few centuries, but I should be able to control the mechanism inside if I can...
Leo placed his hand on the marble floor. He could sense old bronze gears under the surface of the stone. Regular bronze would have corroded and become unusable long ago, but these were celestial bronze, the handiwork of a demigod. With a little willpower, Leo urged them to move, using the Roman numerals to guide him. The cylinders turn. Click, click, click. Then, click, click. On the floor next to the wall, one section of marble tile slid under another, revealing a dark square opening barely large enough to wiggle through.
Romans must have been small,
Leo looked at Frank appraisingly.
You'll need to change into something thinner to get through here.
That's not nice, Hazel chided.
What? Just saying.
Don't worry about it, Frank mumbled. We should go get the others before we explore. That's what Piper said.
They're halfway across the city, Leo reminded him. Besides, I'm not sure I can close this hatch again. The gears are pretty old.
Great, Frank said. How do we know it's safe down there?
Hazel knelt. She put her hand over the opening as if checking the temperature.
There's nothing alive, at least not for several hundred feet. The tunnel slants down, then levels out and goes south, more or less. I don't sense any traps.
How can you tell all that?
Leo asked. She shrugged.
Same way you can pick locks on marble columns, I guess. I'm glad you're not into robbing banks. Oh, bank vaults, Leo said. Never thought about that.
Forget I said anything, Hazel sighed. Look, it's not 3 o'clock yet. We can at least do a little exploring, try to pinpoint Nico's location before we contact the others. You two stay here until I call for you. I want to check things out. Make sure the tunnel is structurally sound.
I'll be able to tell more once I'm underground. Frank scowled.
We can't let you go by yourself. You could get hurt.
Frank, I can take care of myself, she said. Underground is my specialty. It's safest for all of us if I go first.
Unless Frank wants to turn into a mole, Leo suggested. Or a prairie dog. Those things are awesome.
Shut up, Frank mumbled.
Or a badger.
Frank jabbed a finger at Leo's face.
Valdez, I swear.
Both of you, be quiet, Hazel scolded. I'll be back soon. Give me 10 minutes. You don't hear from me by then. Never mind. I'll be fine. Just try not to kill each other while I'm down there.
She dropped down the hole. Leo and Frank blocked her from view as best they could. They stood shoulder to shoulder, trying to look casual like it was completely natural for two teenaged guys to hang around Raphael's tomb. Tour groups came and went. Most ignored Leo and Frank. A few people glanced at them apprehensively and kept walking. Maybe the tourists thought they would ask for tips. For some reason, Leo could unnerve people when he grinned. The three American manatees were still hanging out in the middle of the room. One of them wore a t-shirt that said, Roma, as if he'd forget what city he was in if he didn't wear it. Every once in a while, he would glance over at Leo and Frank like he found their presence distasteful. Something about that dude bothered Leo. He wished Hazel would hurry up.
She talked to me earlier, Frank said abruptly. Hazel told me you figured out about my lifeline.
Leo stirred. He'd almost forgotten Frank was standing next to him. Your lifeline? Oh, the burning stick. Right. Leo resisted the urge to set his hand ablaze and yell, Wah-ha-ha! The idea was sort of funny, but he wasn't that cruel. Look, man, he said, it's cool. I'd never do anything to put you in danger. We're on the same team.
Frank fiddled with his Centurion badge.
I always knew fire could kill me, but since my grandmother's mansion burned down in Vancouver, it seems a lot more real.
Leo nodded. He felt sympathy for Frank, but the guy didn't make it easy when he talked about his family mansion. Sort of like saying, I crashed my Lamborghini, and waiting for people to say, oh, you poor baby. Of course Leo didn't tell him that. Your grandmother, did she die in that fire? You didn't say.
I don't know. She was sick, and pretty old. She said she would die in her own time, in her own way. But I think she made it out of the fire. I saw this bird flying up from the flames.
Leo thought about that. So your whole family has this shape-changing thing?
I guess, Frank said. My mom did. Grandmother thought that's what got her killed in Afghanistan in the war. Mom tried to help some of her buddies and... I don't know exactly what happened. There was a firebomb.
Leo winced with sympathy. So we both lost our moms to fire. He hadn't been planning on it, but he told Frank the whole story of the night at the workshop when Gia had appeared to him and his mother had died. Frank's eyes got watery.
I never like it when people tell me, sorry about your mom.
It never feels genuine, Leo agreed.
But I'm sorry about your mom.
Thanks. No sign of Hazel. The American tourists were still milling around the Pantheon. They seemed to be circling closer, like they were trying to sneak up on Raphael's tomb without it noticing.
Back at Camp Jupiter, Frank said. Our cabin Lar Reticulus told me I have more power than most demigods, being a son of Mars, plus having the shape-changing ability from my mom's side. He said that's why my life is tied to a burning stick. It's such a huge weakness that it kind of balances things out.
Leo remembered his conversation with Nemesis, the revenge goddess at the Great Salt Lake. She'd said something similar about wanting the scales to balance.
Good luck is a sham. True success requires sacrifice.
Her fortune cookie was still in Leo's tool belt, waiting to be opened.
Soon you will face a problem you cannot solve, though I could help you for a price.
Leo wished he could pluck that memory out of his head and shove it in his tool belt. It was taking up too much space.
We've all got weaknesses, he said. Me, for instance, I'm tragically funny and good-looking.
Frank snorted.
You might have weaknesses, but your life doesn't depend on a piece of firewood.
No, Leo admitted. He started thinking, if Frank's problem were his problem, how would he solve it? Almost every design flaw could be fixed.
I wonder.
He looked across the room and faltered. The three American tourists were coming their way, no more circling or sneaking. They were making a straight line for Raphael's tomb, and all three were glaring at Leo.
Frank? Leo asked. Has it been 10 minutes yet?
Frank followed his gaze. The Americans' faces were angry and confused, like they were sleepwalking through a very annoying nightmare.
Leo, Valdez,
called the guy in the Roma shirt. His voice had changed. It was hollow and metallic. He spoke English as if it was a second language.
We meet again.
All three tourists blinked, and their eyes turned solid gold. Frank yelped,
Eidolons!
The manatees clenched their beefy fists. Normally, Leo wouldn't have worried about getting murdered by overweight guys in floppy hats, but he suspected the Eidolons were dangerous even in those bodies, especially since the spirits wouldn't care whether their hosts survived or not.
They can't fit down the hole, Leo said.
Right, Frank said. Underground is sounding really good.
He turned into a snake and slithered over the edge. Leo jumped in after him while the spirits began to wail above.
Valdez! Kill! Valdez!
Chapter 38 Leo. One problem solved. The hatch above them closed automatically, cutting off their pursuers. It also cut off all the light, but Leo and Frank could deal with that. Leo just hoped they didn't need to get out the same way they came in. He wasn't sure he could open the tile from underneath. At least the possessed manatee dudes were on the other side. Over Leo's head, the marble floor shuddered like fat, touristy feet were kicking it. Frank must have turned back to human form. Leo could hear him wheezing in the dark.
What now?
Frank asked.
Okay, don't freak, Leo said. I'm going to summon a little fire just so we can see.
Thanks for the warning.
Leo's index finger blazed like a birthday candle. In front of them stretched a stone tunnel with a low ceiling, just as Hazel had predicted. It slanted down, then leveled out and went south.
Well, Leo said, it only goes in one direction.
Let's find Hazel,
Frank said. Leo had no argument with that suggestion. They made their way down the corridor, Leo going first with the fire. He was glad to have Frank at his back, big and strong and able to turn into scary animals in case those possessed tourists somehow broke through the hatch, squeezed inside, and followed them. He wondered if the Eidolons might just leave those bodies behind, seep underground, and possess one of them instead.
Oh, there's my happy thought for the day, Leo scolded himself.
After 100 feet or so, they turned a corner and found Hazel. In the light of her golden cavalry sword, she was examining a door. She was so engrossed, she didn't notice them until Leo said,
Hi!
Hazel whirled, trying to swing her spatha. Fortunately for Leo's face, the blade was too long to wield in the corridor.
What are you doing here?
Hazel demanded. Leo gulped.
Sorry, we ran into some angry tourists.
He told her what had happened. She hissed in frustration.
I hate Eidolons. I thought Piper made them promise to stay away.
Oh,
Frank said, like he'd just had his own daily happy thought.
Piper made them promise to stay off the ship and not possess any of us. But if they followed us and used other bodies to attack us, then they're not technically breaking their vow.
Great, Leo muttered. Eidolons, who are also lawyers. Now I really want to kill them.
Okay, forget them for now. Hazel said.
This door is giving me fits. Leo, can you try your skill with the lock?
Leo cracked his knuckles.
Stand aside for the master, please.
The door was interesting, much more complicated than the Roman numeral combination lock above. The entire door was coated in imperial gold. A mechanical sphere about the size of a bowling ball was embedded in the center. The sphere was constructed from 5 concentric rings, each inscribed with zodiac symbols. The bull, the scorpion, etc. And seemingly random numbers and letters.
These letters are Greek, Leo said in surprise.
Well, lots of Romans spoke Greek, Hazel said.
I guess, Leo said. But this workmanship, no offense to you Camp Jupiter types, but this is too complicated to be Roman.
Frank snorted.
Whereas you Greeks just love making things complicated.
Hey, Leo protested. All I'm saying is this machinery is delicate, sophisticated. It reminds me of...
Leo stared at the sphere, trying to recall where he'd read or heard about a similar ancient machine.
It's a more advanced sort of lock, he decided. You line up the symbols on the different rings in the right order, and that opens the door.
But what's the right order? Hazel asked.
Good question. Greek spheres, astronomy, geometry.
Leo got a warm feeling inside.
Oh, no way. I wonder, what's the value of pi?
Frank frowned.
What kind of pi?
He means the number, Hazel guessed. I learned that in math class once, but...
It's used to measure circles, Leo said. This sphere, if it's made by the guy I'm thinking of...
Hazel and Frank both stared at him blankly.
Never mind, Leo said. I'm pretty sure pi is, 3.1415, blah, blah, blah. The number goes on forever, but the sphere has only 5 rings, so that should be enough, if I'm right.
And if you're not? Frank asked.
Well, then, Leo, fall down, go boom. Let's find out.
He turned the rings, starting on the outside and moving in. He ignored the zodiac signs and letters, lining up the correct numbers so they made the value of pi. Nothing happened.
I'm stupid, Leo mumbled. Pi would expand outward because it's infinite.
He reversed the order of the numbers, starting in the center and working toward the edge. When he aligned the last ring, something inside the sphere clicked. The door swung open. Leo beamed at his friends.
That, good people, is how we do things in Leo World. Come on in.
I hate Leo World,
Frank muttered. Hazel laughed. Inside was enough cool stuff to keep Leo busy for years. The room was about the size of the forge back at Camp Half-Blood, with bronze-topped work tables along the walls and baskets full of ancient metalworking tools. Dozens of bronze and gold spheres like steampunk basketballs sat around in various stages of disassembly. Loose gears and wiring littered the floor. Thick metal cables ran from each table toward the back of the room, where there was an enclosed loft like a theater's sound booth. Stairs led up to the booth on either side. All the cables seemed to run into it. Next to the stairs, on the left, a row of cubbyholes was filled with leather cylinders, probably ancient scroll cases. Leo was about to head toward the tables when he glanced to his left and nearly jumped out of his shoes. Flanking the doorway were 2 armored mannequins, like skeletal scarecrows made from bronze pipes, outfitted with full suits of Roman armor, shield, and sword.
Dude, Leo walked up to one. These would be awesome if they worked.
Frank edged away from the mannequins.
Those things are going to come alive and attack us, aren't they?
Leo laughed.
Not a chance. They aren't complete.
He tapped the nearest mannequin's neck, where loose copper wires sprouted from underneath its breastplate.
Look, the head's wiring has been disconnected, and here at the elbow, the pulley system for this joint is out of alignment. My guess, the Romans were trying to duplicate a Greek design, but they didn't have the skill.
Hazel arched her eyebrows.
The Romans weren't good enough at being complicated, I suppose.
Or delicate, Frank added. Or sophisticated.
Hey, I just call it like I see it.
Leo jiggled the mannequin's head, making it nod like it was agreeing with him.
Still, a pretty impressive try. I've heard legends that the Romans confiscated the writings of Archimedes, but...
Archimedes? Hazel looked baffled. Wasn't he an ancient mathematician or something? Leo laughed.
He was a lot more than that. He was only the most famous son of Hephaestus who ever lived.
Frank scratched his ear.
I've heard his name before, but how can you be sure this mannequin is his design?
It has to be, Leo said. Look, I've read all about Archimedes. He's a hero to Cabin 9. The dude was Greek, right? He lived in one of the Greek colonies in southern Italy, back before Rome got all huge and took over. Finally, the Romans moved in and destroyed his city. The Roman general wanted to spare Archimedes, because he was so valuable. Sort of like the Einstein of the ancient world. But some stupid Roman soldier killed him.
There you go again, Hazel muttered. Stupid and Roman don't always go together, Leo.
Frank grunted agreement.
How do you know all this anyway? He demanded. Is there a Spanish tour guide around here?
No, man, Leo said. You can't be a demigod who's into building stuff and not know about Archimedes. The guy was seriously elite. He calculated the value of pi. He did all this math stuff we still use for engineering. He invented a hydraulic screw that could move water through pipes.
Hazel scowled.
A hydraulic screw. Excuse me for not knowing about that awesome achievement. He also built a death ray made of mirrors that could burn enemy ships, Leo said. Is that awesome enough for you?
I saw something about that on TV, Frank admitted. They proved it didn't work.
That's just because modern mortals don't know how to use celestial bronze, Leo said. That's the key. Archimedes also embedded a massive claw that could swing on a crane and pluck enemy ships out of the water.
Okay, that's cool, Frank admitted. I love grabber arm games.
Well, there you go, Leo said. Anyway, all his inventions weren't enough. The Romans destroyed his city. Archimedes was killed. According to legends, the Roman general was a big fan of his work, so he raided Archimedes' workshop and carted a bunch of souvenirs back to Rome. They disappeared from history. Except, Leo waved his hands at the stuff on the tables. Here they are.
Metal basketballs? Hazel asked.
Leo couldn't believe that they didn't appreciate what they were looking at, but he tried to contain his irritation.
Guys, Archimedes constructed spheres. The Romans couldn't figure them out. They thought they were just for telling time or following constellations, because they were covered with pictures of stars and planets. But that's like finding a rifle and thinking it's a walking stick.
Leo, the Romans were top-notch engineers, Hazel reminded him. They built aqueducts, roads.
Siege weapons, Frank added. Public sanitation.
Yeah, fine, Leo said. But Archimedes was in a class by himself. His spheres could do all sorts of things, only nobody is sure.
Suddenly Leo got an idea so incredible that his nose burst into flames. He patted it out as quickly as possible. Man, it was embarrassing when that happened. He ran to the row of cubbyholes and examined the markings on the scroll cases.
Oh, gods, this is it.
He gingerly lifted out one of the scrolls. He wasn't great at ancient Greek, but he could tell the inscription on the case read, On Building Spheres.
Guys, this is the lost book.
His hands were shaking.
Archimedes wrote this, describing his construction methods, but all the copies were lost in ancient times. If I can translate this...
The possibilities were endless. For Leo, the quest had now totally taken on a new dimension. Leo had to get the spheres and scrolls safely out of here. He had to protect this stuff until he could get it back to Bunker 9 and study it.
The secrets of Archimedes, he murmured. Guys, this is bigger than Daedalus's laptop. If there's a Roman attack on Camp Half-Blood, these secrets could save the camp. They might even give us an edge over Gia and the Giants.
Hazel and Frank glanced at each other skeptically.
Okay, Hazel said. We didn't come here for a scroll, but I guess we can take it with us.
Assuming, Frank added, that you don't mind sharing its secrets with us stupid, uncomplicated Romans.
What?
Leo stared at him blankly.
No, look, I didn't mean to insult. Never mind. The point is, this is good news. For the first time in days, Leo felt really hopeful. Naturally, that's when everything went wrong. On the table next to Hazel and Frank, one of the orbs clicked and whirred. A row of spindly legs extended from its equator. The orb stood, and two bronze cables shot out of the top, hitting Hazel and Frank.